And we are now going to the Horn Report. And this is an interview off of Black Agenda Radio with Glenn Ford. And Dr. Gerald Horn is talking about his book, Negro Comrades of the Crown.
Dr. Gerald Horn is a professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston. His latest book is titled Negroes of the Crown, in which he contends that the American Revolution was actually a white settler rebellion to perpetuate slavery. Most black slaves were acutely aware of that fact and favored the British side in the war.
There are different trends that take place in the writing of history. That is to say, even though the basic facts may not change, but our interpretations change. And our interpretations oftentimes change because the needs of different generations change. Look at W.E.B. Du Bois and his book on Black Reconstruction, which upended the then reigning interpretation of that period following the U.S. Civil War, i.e. 1865 to 1876, which theretofore had been seen as an era of Negro corruption and misdeeds and all the rest, and Du Bois put it in the exact opposite way. And I think that we're well overdue for a reinterpretation of the history of the United States, because a lot of the basic narrative really doesn't make any sense. What I mean is, if this was such a grand revolution, as it has been taught to us, even by so-called progressive historians, then how did it end up so badly as a Leviathan? Why did conditions for the enslaved population actually worsen after the rebels defeated the British? Why did it take until 1965 for basic voting rights to be validated after the so-called Grand Revolution? And I think as well, because of the rise of China, which I think is going to shake the psyche and the confidence of the U.S. elite, and I might also say the U.S. population as a whole, there's going to be a groping for a new interpretation that fits the current conditions. And I think this is where my book comes in. Because basically what I say in this book is that the revolt against British rule was basically a successful revolt of racist settlers. That is to say that it was akin to Rhodesia in 1965, assuming that Ian Smith and his cabal had triumphed. It was akin to the revolt of the French settlers in Algeria, North Africa, in the 1950s and the 1960s, assuming that those French settlers had triumphed. And just as it would have been difficult for Rhodesia or French Algeria to construct a progressive republic after a racist revolt, it was very difficult to construct a progressive republic in North America after what was basically a racist revolt. Now, the book at hand, of course, deals with a number of episodes where I show that the Africans were basically not on board with the revolt against British rule, not least because the revolt in British rule against British rule was motivated in no small part by the fact that abolitionism was growing in London and was thought in North America to be on course to spread to the entire British Empire. This is one of the many reasons why you had more Africans by an order of magnitude who fought against the rebels in 1776 and fought alongside the rebels. And this is why the War of 1812, whose bicentennial will be marked within a few weeks, that is to say in 2012, the War of 1812 was probably witnessed the longest and most sustained period of unrest by enslaved Africans in the history of the United States, even though this may come as a surprise to many people who study history for a living. You may recall that it was in August 1814 that the Redcoats took the torch to Washington, D.C. You may not know that there were Negroes and Redcoats who were present in great numbers. You may know that one of the reasons why Washington, that is to say the United States, had such difficulty in defeating the British in that war was because they always had to worry about their backside. That is to say, if they sent their so-called white troops out to confront the British, they had to worry as to whether or not the enslaved Africans would then seize the opportunity to revolt, which is basically what happened in Virginia, in Georgia, etc.
And yet, what we know in terms of black folks and the War of 1812 is the story of those colored troops, that's the way they call themselves, who fought with Andrew Jackson in the Battle of New Orleans.
That's true, and that is a fact, and I have quite a bit of new evidence with regard to that. It's very curious. One of the most sustained and violent episodes of slave unrest took place in 1811 in Louisiana. In fact, Louisiana as a state probably has the broadest and deepest history of revolt against slavery by black folk than any other state in the so-called Union. And this slave revolt of 1811 was basically squashed, not least because of the assistance, I'm afraid, of so-called colored troops and militia who were enlisted on the part of the authorities. And the Battle of New Orleans, basically erupting at the end of 1814 and the beginning of 1815, not only saw the use of these colored troops on behalf of the Stars and Stripes, but also you should know that about maybe 10 to 15% of those fighting under the Union Jack, especially fighting with the British troops, were of African descent, mostly Jamaicans. Because you need to know that Africans in the hemisphere, and perhaps even worldwide, looked at the United States the way that we looked at apartheid South Africa in the 20th century. That is to say, it was like a holy crusade to oppose the United States of America by Africans worldwide, and particularly by those in the Caribbean. I talk in the book about a number of episodes where the slave masters of Virginia in particular were seeking to transport enslaved Africans to the newer territories, such as in Mississippi, for example, in the first few decades of the 20th century. You may know that Virginia, by the first few decades of the 19th century, it had basically become something of a breeding state, and I mean what I say there. That is, it was basically breeding Africans for export. And so what was happening is that they were trying to transport these Africans to Mississippi in particular. The problem was, how did you get those Africans to Mississippi? If you went overland, you had to face the prospect of rebellious indigenous people who did not necessarily cotton to the idea of these Euro-American reaching across their territory. So they were trying to do it by ship. But what would happen is that sometimes the ships would be blown into Bermuda, for example, which is only a few hundred miles off the coast of the United States. And so what would happen is that the British, and particularly the Africans in Bermuda, would then clamor for these Africans to be free. Now, let's back up for a second and acknowledge that Britain in its colonies was a slave-owning power, but abolitionism sunk deeper roots in the British Empire than in the Republic, not least because this Republic, that is the United States of America, was basically born as a settlers' revolt in order to perpetuate slavery because they were afraid of the import and impact of abolitionism, particularly in Somerset's case, which comes in June 1772 in London, which seems to suggest that abolitionism is going to be spreading across the entire import. And, of course, Somerset's case helps to light the fuse for 1776. I should also say that by the first few decades of the 19th century, the British were coming to rely very heavily upon African labor. And they were then worried that the European settlers would do a replay of 1776. And, of course, that was in the minds of these European settlers in Bermuda, for example, and in Nassau and the Bahamas, too, for that matter. So London was beginning to sideline and marginalize the European settlers in these colonies, which is why some of them then migrated to the United States. St. George Tucker, for example, who was a leading figure in Virginia in the early 19th century, particularly with regard to Gabriel's Revolt in Richmond and about 1800 in Virginia, was from Bermuda, as were a number of other leading figures. And so when these boats, these slave ships, would then be blown off course into Bermuda, the Africans would clamor for their release, and then Britain, which still had a bone to pick with the United States, because they were still smarting from the revolt against British rule. And then the hubristic statements by the Republicans, that is, say, the U.S. Nationals, that they had discovered the secret to humanity and the secret to happiness by overthrowing British rule, this was a way to stick it to the United States. And this was a way to basically stir up controversy in the United States. And so they would oftentimes free these Africans, and this happened repeatedly. And so this was also helping to carry the favor of the enslaved Africans on North American soil. It's a well-known diplomatic tactic to carry favor with the dissidents of your opponent. I mean, for example, it's no secret, for example, that the United States got quite a bit of traction during the Cold War by appealing to those in the Soviet Union who had a bone to pick with Moscow. For example, these large campaigns on behalf of Soviet Jewry, which of course led to a major migration to Israel from Russia and helping to bolster, I'm afraid, the right-wing population of Israel. So London was attempting the same sort of maneuver by currying favor with these enslaved Africans in the states of the United States of America.
So as you explained it, Frederick Douglass's rebuke to the United States with his famous 4th of July address was actually speaking for the African diaspora, and his trips to Britain for fundraising and for agitation are certainly in context with this.
Not only that, but you need to realize, now buckle your seatbelts, Mr. Ford, and also a listening audience, the Africans did not see the revolt against British rule and the establishment of the United States as legitimate. Just as you have numerous Cuban Americans in Florida and in New York who did not see the revolution in 1959 as legitimate, which is why they don't see why the United States should recognize the state. Well, Africans felt the same way about the United States of America. Now, let me step back for a second and put this in even a broader context. Another reason for the help shed light on what I'm talking about is the Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804. The Haitian Revolution basically upset the calculus with regard to slavery, as I note in the book, and basically induces a general crisis of the slave system that can only be resolved with its collapse, which happens in the United States, 1861, 1865, with the U.S. Civil War, and 1888, with the final collapse of slavery in Brazil. What I mean by that is that 1791 to 1804, particularly the early years of the revolt against French rule in Haiti, you saw many of the major powers, including London, they sought to intervene against the Africans in Haiti. And London suffered one of the most ignominious defeats in its long history with its intervention against the Africans in Haiti. And after suffering that defeat, the Londoners, the elite of the British Empire, stepped back for a second, and they recognized that the jig was up with regard to slavery, not least because Haiti was quite close to Jamaica, one of the crown jewels of the British Empire, and that, like successful revolutionaries anywhere, the Haitians would try to spread their seditious message, not least in their own neighborhood. And so I quote at length from Londoners saying, wait a minute, the jig is up, it's time to reconfigure. You can draw a straight line from the Haitian Revolution to London moving to abolish slavery in the empire approximately three decades later. But the United States of America did not, perhaps at that moment, could not draw that conclusion, not least because they were born as a revolt against abolitionism, not least because, as noted, the most powerful state in the Union was Virginia, Thomas Jefferson's Virginia, and not least because a great deal, a disproportionate amount of the capital in the United States was embodied in the bodies of Africans. And so as London then accelerated its path towards abolitionism with the Haitian Revolution, the United States dug in its heels. And then that led basically to collaborations between Port-au-Prince, that is to say Haiti, and Britain against the United States on many different levels, which I detail in the book. So the Haitian Revolution, it seems to me, as has been noted by many writers and analysts previously, was quite a boon to the abolitionist movement in the United States, which is why we still owe a major debt of gratitude to Haiti.
How much are the white settler revolt origins of the United States reflected in U.S. imperial policy today?
Oh, it's reflected all across the board. I mean, first of all, you have this idea, this mythology, which still is taught in universities, I'm afraid, of isolationism. But actually, this isolationism had many different strands. First of all, the United States was basically consolidating its rule in North America, fighting indigenous nations, that's to say Native American nations, and therefore it wanted the Londoners to butt out, because there's another story to be told, and it has been told to a certain degree, about how the Native Americans as well were collaborating with London against Washington. And I tell this story as it manifests itself in Florida, where you have some of the bloodiest wars the United States has been involved in its bloody history, the so-called Seminole Wars, three Seminole Wars, in fact, 1818, 1819, 1830s, and 1850s, where you basically had Africans and indigenous people combining as one against the extension of Washington's rule in what is now the Sunshine State. Sadly, as we know, that did not work itself out. So, yes, it's very important to point out that this whole idea of isolationism was not only a way to allow Washington to continue its routing of Native American peoples, but also to keep London and other powers from interfering on behalf of Africans and on behalf of Native Americans. Because keep in mind that there's substantial contestation for North America. Somehow now, I guess we sort of see after the fact, sadly enough, that it was inevitable. It was far from inevitable. I mean, for example, Russia was involved on the West Coast. You know that the United States buys Alaska from Russia, 1867, Seward's Folly, it was called at the time after Secretary of State William Seward, but actually, as is now recognized, it was really a steal, not to mention a travesty in terms of the rights of the indigenous people of Alaska. But even California, there was major contestation for California in the 1840s and 1850s, not only between the United States and Mexico, but also Russia and Britain. Indeed, one of the things I point out when I get to California history, after the defeat of Mexico in that war of aggression, 1846 to 1848, and then the discovery of gold in Northern California, the area around Sacramento, California, is that you had a major influx into Northern California from Australia, because it, in some ways, it was easier to get to California from Australia than to get to California from New York. I mean, you could just take a ship, straight shot from Sydney, whereas from New York, you'd have to fight Native Americans every step of the way. You have these Australians flooding in. They're being lynched by the Euro-Americans because they see them, correctly so, as stalking horses for London. Because there's a so-called special relationship between Britain and the United States today, people read that back, which is oftentimes what historians and, of course, non-historians do. But, of course, Britain in the mid-19th century was like the Al-Qaeda of today, in other words. It was a hated country, except by the Africans, who, of course, tended to be pro-London because they saw London as a standard bearer of abolitionism. So in any case, you also have the Negroes being lynched in Northern California. So what happens? Sir James Douglas, who is a man of color, who is the governor of what is now British Columbia, and indeed the founding father of British Columbia. One of the interesting aspects of this book, I think, is that because Britain had this far-flung empire and had a relatively small population, it had to rely more on Negroes to be administrators. I mean, you hardly have black governors today in the United States. I mean, Deval Patrick and who else, for example. But in British Columbia, in the mid-19th century, you had Sir James Douglas. He makes an appeal to the Negroes of San Francisco to move northward, where he says you can vote. And in fact, the cover of this book is a picture of the Negroes from San Francisco who move to what is now British Columbia after the appeal of Sir James Douglas and take up arms on behalf of Britain and the British Empire, because, of course, Canada was part of the British Empire, at a time when relations between the British Empire and Washington were, of course, in its usual bad state. One of the larger takeaways, I think, that our readers should note from this book is that the dirty secret, as I put it, of the progress of people of African descent in the United States of America has been that we have made progress to the extent we have been able to stiff-arm and ignore U.S. sovereignty. Parenthetically, that's one of the reasons I think that our friends on the left missed the boat with the Battle of Seattle 1999, the anti-World Trade Organization protest, where part of the cry of some was that they felt the World Trade Organization was somehow detracting from U.S. sovereignty. As I said at the time, I'd rather take my chances any day. If I only have two choices, I'll take my chances with a faceless bureaucrat in Geneva any day than a faceless bureaucrat in Washington, D.C. I mean, that's been the lesson of our history. So that line about protecting U.S. sovereignty obviously needs to go into the trash heap of history. I mean, it's ludicrous.
And we can see a straight line from that attitude towards the United States and its claims as a nation being antithetical to black claims to humanity, a line straight to Malcolm X advocating that black folks in the United States treat the United States government as one would a foreign oppressor and bring it to the United Nations.
Oh, absolutely. And, of course, there have been many episodes, fortunately, in the 20th century trying to take the United States to the United Nations. This is why this book, I think, is probably going to get a better reception. As a matter of fact, it already is getting a better reception in Canada and London and Australia than in the United States, where I think it'll either be trashed or ignored, quite frankly. It's because it goes against some of the mythology. It goes against the creation myth of the United States, that it's born in this grand revolution. But also some of our friends on the left, I think, perhaps understandably, they painted this picture where they see themselves in many ways as standing in the footsteps of Thomas Jefferson. You might recall the Jefferson School of Social Science of the 1950s, which was started by the Communist Party, where Lorraine Hansberry, the great playwright, basically received their political education, for example, named after Thomas Jefferson. And I think that many people on the left, they feel that they're marginal already. And so then to go against the creation myth of the United States will make them doubly and triply marginal.
And would this include Howard Zinn?
Howard Zinn, bless his soul. I respected Howard Zinn, and I think he did great work. And he's now sadly passed away, and I've tried to avoid saying anything that doesn't smile upon him, not least because he's not here to defend himself. But having said that, I have to accept the premise of your question. I mean, I think it sort of overstates the case. I mean, you get the idea that John Brown, the great Euro-American anti-slavery crusader who gave his life to help to free the enslaved, was sort of the rule. He was a distinct exception. But not only that, John Brown, as I point out in the book, basically, he went to Europe. In fact, to Britain, to confer with abolitionists before coming back to Harper's Ferry. A lot of the planning for Harper's Ferry, 1859, was done in Canada, which then became a target for the Confederate States of America during the U.S. Civil War of 1861-1865. Not only that, but I point to other Euro-Canadians, in fact, who in some ways outstripped Harriet Tubman, the great black woman rescuer of the enslaved, in terms of going into the South and rescuing slaves and bringing them back to Canada, for example. This is part of this conflict between the British Empire and the United States. And so, obviously, what I'm saying, I'm sure our friends on the left will not find it useful to their present struggle, but like the United States always tells other people, like they told the people in the Balkans in the 1990s, you know, you need to face your history. As bitter and as painful as it might be, you need to face it. Well, that's what I'm saying to these people of the United States of America. You need to face your history. Particularly, it's going to have to be faced because, as I said, this rise of China and the rise of Brazil and the rise of India is really going to cause a major psychic crisis in the United States. And so the better we face our history and get the true realities out, the more ahead of the curve we'll be.
Dr. Gerald Horn, the full title of his book is Negroes of the Crown, African Americans and the British Empire Fight the U.S. Before Emancipation.
That was Dr. Gerald Horn on the Black River Gender Report with Glenn Ford, and he was talking about his book, Negroes, Comrades of the Crown. You are listening to Saturday Morning Live. This is Radio Regent, and that was Amandla out of CKUT with Doug Miller and Gwen Shulman.